FM4 ORF RT/podcast.
Well, tomorrow, the US presidential hopefuls face off in the last of their televised debates. Donald Trump, of course, versus Hillary Clinton. And the rhetoric could hardly be running any higher, at least from the Trump camp. Well, as Donald Trump criticizes and continues to plummet in the polls, he's now hitting at the very foundation of American democracy, the electoral process itself, by claiming that the whole election here will be rigged. Well, many commentators are saying that this is just more Trump bluster, as he comes up with any excuse for his likely defeat. However, some see his latest outbursts as something more sinister. Well, I asked U.S. political historian and commentator James Boyce for his view here.
What is important to note is that of all the things that Donald Trump has said and all the people he's attacked, I arguably think that his latest remarks attacking the veracity of the American political system itself are the most dangerous things he's actually come out with, because ever since George Washington was president, there has been the concept of the peaceful transference of power to one's political opponents. You know, you run, if you win, you assume office, if you don't, you retire gracefully and you concede. And that has happened all the way through American political history, even in ridiculously close elections such as 2000 and 1960. There was no disputing ultimately the veracity of the results. So what Donald Trump and his surrogates, it must be said, are doing, I think, is planting very, very dangerous seeds with regards to the result that's going to come out in November, something he's only done since it's become very, very apparent to one and all that his performance could even come in under less than Mitt Romney achieved 4 years ago.
The Trump campaign would say, well, look at the chorus of women and the allegations they're making against Mr. Trump of sexual impropriety. This is all coming out just a few weeks before the election. Do they have a point here?
Well, let's be honest, let's flip it around. Donald Trump, you know, the old concept, you live by the sword, you die by the sword. Donald Trump was very, very happy to make Bill Clinton's past political indiscretions and personal indiscretions part of this election when the poll suddenly went against him. If you take Donald Trump's line, we should believe all these women accusing Bill Clinton without any apparent proof, and yet we should dismiss anybody claiming anything against Donald Trump, who weakly have seemingly a lack of proof. So, you know, he wants to have it both ways, quite frankly, and that's just not how the game is played.
Assuming the polls are right, assuming Hillary Clinton is the next president, is Donald Trump going to go away, do you think, quietly?
I don't think Donald Trump's ever done anything quietly, quite frankly. I think that what you'll see is him continue to be a thorn in the flesh of a Hillary Clinton presidency. It has long been suggested that he never actually wants to be president. What he wants to do is establish a new media outlet of some sort. And certainly there are increasing rumors to that effect. He's obviously got Roger Ailes on board, his team now. He had run Fox News for many years. So I wouldn't be at all surprised to see within the first term of a Hillary Clinton presidency, Donald Trump establish a rival to Fox News, say, for example, with Breitbart's chief executive involved particularly, and be a major conservative agitator against Hillary Clinton presidency.
Donald Trump and his claims. The thoughts there of US political commentator James Boyce.
FM4. Reality check.
Now, an unprecedented lawsuit against oil drilling in the Arctic, it's been launched in Norway. The case has been brought against the government by the Norwegian NGO Nature and Youth and Greenpeace Nordic. Well, the Norwegian government has been issuing licenses to drill oil in the Arctic for decades now, and in this latest round, 13 new licenses were handed out back in May. Well, Adam Pavlov from Greenpeace here in Austria told Joanna Bostock why this round is raising such concern here.
What's particularly bad about this round is it's the furthest north they've ever gone. Two licenses in particular, which are in the so-called 30-year ice line, so where the Arctic sea ice has been in the past 30 years would cover. That makes them particularly dangerous, because not only are the conditions there hazardous enough as it is, but if an oil spill were to reach water which is covered in oil, then you can't clean it up.
And what's the legal argument on which this lawsuit is actually based?
So 2 years ago, Norway amended their constitution, and there's an article 112. In essence, what it says is it guarantees future generations the right to both a safe and an intact and productive environment. And what we're saying is the Arctic oil licenses, being that they're quite dangerous, and the risk of an oil spill is there, directly contravenes that right. So that's one of the arguments we're basing this case on. The other argument is the Paris Agreement. So Norway was one of the first countries to ratify the Paris Agreement on climate change, which states we want to keep temperature below 2, and if we can, below 1.5 degrees. Now, what we need to remember is that if we take all the oil, coal and gas in production already, that would take us beyond 2 degrees. So the question we're posing is, why are we looking for new oil resources?
And presumably you have a team of fairly high-profile lawyers on this. What do they say are the chances of actually being successful with this case? Or could we also see it perhaps as a bit of a publicity stunt?
Well, I wouldn't call it a publicity stunt. I mean, what our lawyers have said is that as this is a unique case, we're not able to quantify the chances of winning. But we wouldn't be there if we didn't think we had a fair chance of winning. I mean, the Constitution is fairly clear. Well, I would certainly say this case is definitely about winning the court of public opinion on the issue of Arctic oil drilling. So that's definitely an issue. But we do believe we have a fair chance of winning this case in the court of law as well.
Thoughts there from Adam Pavlov from Greenpeace. Now, this lawsuit has broad support in Norway from scientists, from indigenous groups and prominent figures as well, including the philosopher and author of the book Sophie's World, Jostein Gaarder.
For me, it's a no-brainer, as we say. I mean, if all the oil still to be found on this planet is extracted and released into the atmosphere, our civilization will quite simply not survive.
And as a philosopher, I understand that you have said that you believe one of the most important philosophical questions of our time is how to preserve this planet for future generations.
That's correct. You know, when I wrote Sophie's World 25 years ago, I didn't write about this at all. Often I'm asked by people if I think that the philosophical questions are eternal. Well, yes, many of the philosophical questions are eternal, like, what is this universe, or does God exist, and things like that, you know. But every now and then, quite new and very fundamental philosophical questions arise. And I will, with no hesitation, say that the most important philosophical question is this question you mentioned. How can we be able to preserve life conditions on Earth?
The thoughts there of Jostein Gaarder, the author of Sophie's World.
FM Fear.
Has postings on the internet free speech versus hate speech? It is a hot topic right now in Austria, but a court ruling in Germany has made the headlines there too. Because yesterday a court in Würzburg sentenced a Facebook user to jail for xenophobic comments. Abrim Hegazi spoke to the ORF's bureau chief in Berlin, Birgit Schwarz, to find out more.
There has been a surge of hate postings with the beginning and during the refugee crisis last year in Germany, but this case predates the crisis. The case is about a man who lives in southern Germany in Bavaria. The authorities know him as a violent right-wing extremist, and 2 years ago this man posted comments on Facebook, hateful comments. He advocated violence against Jews, foreigners and refugees, and he was even calling for murder. The case went to court and the man was convicted yesterday to a jail sentence.
Yeah, he was convicted to 1.5 years in jail for his hate online postings. But it's not the first time Germany has jailed an internet sozusagen troll.
Well, for a long time, hate crimes via internet have been punished mostly with money fines in Germany, even though the German criminal law allows for sentences up to 5 years in jail for a hate crime. This is the first time a court has confirmed the jail sentence after an appeal.
German politician Volker Kauder proposed a fine of 50,000 euros for publishing hate postings.
Well, Volker Kauder is clearly fed up with failing attempts to convince Facebook and other social media providers to cooperate. And about a year ago, the German government has asked internet companies like Facebook, Twitter, Google to remove hateful slogans from their websites within 24 hours after they got reported. But this does not seem to work. Users complain that their requests to remove such postings are simply not met by the companies. And Volker Kauder's proposal of such a big fine is meant to give the government's request that the postings should be removed a little more punch.
Okay, now the German government is also planning to launch a compensation system for victims of online hate speech. This seems like a mega thing, mega task.
I think so far this is more wishful thinking than a plan. You should know, according to German law, if you want compensation, you need to prove that you were damaged by such a hate speech and you need to attach a price tag to the damage. This is much more difficult under the German law system than in Anglo-Saxon countries, and it will be very interesting to see what this plan is going to look like. But the German government has made it very clear it wants to attack the issue of hate speech on the internet from many different angles. And for instance, there also have been police raids across the country to catch people who commit hate crimes in the internet.
That's Birgit Schwarz. She's the ORF's bureau chief in Berlin. And her report also leads to the question, can you actually be sentenced to a jail term for internet hate speech here in Austria? Well, Dr. Johannes Erlbeck is a Vienna-based lawyer specializing in internet laws. And he has the answer to that question.
Es ist grundsätzlich möglich, dass man in Österreich im Gefängnis landet, wenn man Hasspostings setzt. Ja, das ist vorgesehen in Paragraph 283 des Strafgesetzbuches, der den Namen Verhetzung trägt.
FM4. Well, the Austrian government this morning presented plans for changes to the school system. It is an area on which the coalition parties, the SPÖ and the ÖVP, are often at odds. Well, critics say a proper reform of the education system is long overdue, especially in a rapidly changing world economy with increasing numbers of young people excluded from traditional career paths. Well, Professor Stefan Janssen from the Karlshochschule in Karlsruhe told FM4's Rosie Waits that it is really time to redefine what education really means here.
To be honest, education is not in the 21st century a formal thing anymore. So therefore, I would say, please read, please experiment, please do everything for your curiosity. It's not about this degree issue anymore. The truth is, in the 21st century, this will change. And I call that de-school education, because this de-schooling of education is going along with the digitization of education, with gamification. And this is, I think, what is education about? I mean, it's rethinking. It's not just to learn how to think, it is rethinking.
And to learn how to question things
exactly.
As well, because there is so much information available
right.
In the digital space, but is it always correct?
Right. We have to start right away in the kindergarten with just one formula, and it's keep questioning. I don't believe that a lot of professions will survive in the next 50 years.
Because of digitalization.
You don't need really a profession. What you need is curiosity. You need a specific way of combining something which is not combinable. You know, it's all about cognition. So, and it's not clear that people with a degree, a formal university degree, has a better cognition than others. So, and this cognition is something which we have to focus from the very, very early childhood.
So are you saying that people need to be less specialized in a way, more adaptable? So instead of having one career in your lifetime, you might have 6 or 7 careers. You might end up doing a variety of different jobs that require different skills.
Right. I definitely believe in that. This is a new freedom, and it's like, I mean, it's not really a good thing. It's a tough thing. The freedom to because of the digitization of the knowledge, of the accessibility of knowledge, which is already there, to find the new. Every art piece of an artist, and even every business model, which is not really proved yet, it is a risk. It is uncertainty of the future. And that is, in our educational system, we are always focusing on the security of the past and not of the insecurity of the future.
So do you think universities and educators are going to have to change to survive, to be relevant?
Definitely. I would always say the scientific world has to be more trivial in a very complex way, and they can learn from radio stations, from television, from YouTube or whatever, so that there will be hybridization.
That's Stephen Jansen. He's director of the Center for Philanthropy and Civil Society at the Karlshochschule in Karlsruhe. He was in Vienna last month for the Globe Art Festival.
FM4. Reality check.
Well, in a surprise development yesterday, it was revealed that Britain's NatWest Bank is to close the accounts of the Russian state broadcaster RT, or Russia Today. Well, RT broadcasts 24 hours a day in English, and it is widely seen, at least as a public relations tool and maybe more a propaganda machine for the Kremlin. Well, British Prime Minister Theresa May, she says it was the bank's decision to close the accounts of RT, and it was nothing to do with the British government. But some commentators are not convinced. So I asked Russia analyst John Luff from the Chatham House think tank in London about his reaction to this news here.
The news came as a big surprise in London. I don't think anybody had seen this coming just now. It feels like a move orchestrated by the government ahead of the European Council meeting on Thursday, when EU leaders will discuss relations with Russia. And it comes at a very interesting time when many analysts had expected EU sanctions against Russia to possibly be relaxed in some form. Now, that given Russia's actions in Syria over the last 3 weeks, the breakdown of the ceasefire, the bombardment of Aleppo, the accusations against Russia of possible war crimes, the atmosphere has changed really markedly. And I think we are going to have a rather different discussion about Russia on Thursday from what was anticipated just a few weeks ago.
In the meantime, the thought on RT Russia Today, is there much concern in the UK about this channel?
I don't think that RT has been hugely influential in the UK. Yes, there has been concern because there's been a realisation that this is a Russian state propaganda tool that is peddling large volumes of disinformation. The regulator Ofcom has, I think, issued at least a couple of warnings to RT. So if you like, this is a shot across the bows. I think in some ways it's not surprising that this has happened, because it's, in my view, something that's been long overdue. And it's remarkable in some ways that Russian state media have been able to operate in the UK and, in fact, in other Western countries in the way they have up till now, with certainly RT and, I believe, the news agency Sputnik trying to at least influence opinion around, for example, the Scottish referendum, and perhaps to a lesser extent around the referendum on the UK's membership of the European Union that took place in June.
If it is largely ineffective, we could be running into the danger of, the UK is stifling freedom of speech.
Yeah, I don't buy that argument. If RT was in fact engaged in professional objective journalism rather than something that smells very strongly of state propaganda, then I think one could sustain that argument. But in the view of many people, including in Russia, this is not a news channel that can be regarded in any way as objective.
That's Russia analyst John Luff from the Chatham House think tank there.
FM4 Reality Check.